This episode is brought to you in part by Litvin School of Mission, Ministry, and Leadership at Wheaton College. Our graduate programs in evangelism, ministry, and leadership enrich your mind, spirit, vocation, and character to refine what's already within you. Learn more at wheaton.edu/CT.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McLenathan. And Wade, I know that we had some technical difficulties earlier with the Skype call that we're recording this on, but I want to let you know that if I cut out again, it's not because of the internet, it's because a frog just barreled in through my window from the sky.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, it's weird here, Kevin. All of my water just turned to blood.
That sounds absolutely terrifying, and I would advise you to maybe get out of there as soon as you can.
Listeners, we talk about frogs, plagues, and Paul Thomas Anderson in this week's episode, where we review his 1999 film, Magnolia.
That's right. This is one of the picks from one of our $10 a month patrons. He really wanted us to review Paul Thomas Anderson's 1999 classic. So that's what we're doing on episode 306 of Seeing and Believing.
Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a line to you from an opera. I want you to give me that line back in the language in which the opera was originally written. And for a bonus $250, you can sing it.
I'm Stanley Spector.
There is the story of a boy genius.
Willa Cather. Thomas Kidd, Jean-Baptiste Beauclamoyer.
And the game show host.
And Jimmy Gator.
Live from Burbank, California.
First question for 25. This French playwright and actor joined the Béjart troupe of actors.
And the ex-boy genius.
I'm Chris Kidd-Donny Smith.
I used to be smart, now I'm just stupid.
There is the story of the dying man.
I'm Earl Partridge.
I have a son, you know.
You do?
Find him.
I'm Frank T.J. Mackey.
His lost son.
What did he say? Because I am not going to take care of him. What does he want?
And the dying man's wife.
I'm Linda Partridge.
I took care of him through this, Alan. What now then?
Me and him. Do you understand? There's right. No one else. No one else.
The caretaker.
Hello. I'm Phil Parma.
See, this is the scene of the movie where you help me out.
And there is the story of a mother.
I'm Rose Gator.
You come home soon after the show. I love you.
Love you too.
And the daughter.
I'm Claudia Wilson Gator.
Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again?
And the police officer in love.
I'm Officer Jim Curring.
My life is very stressful, and I'd hope to have a relationship that is very calm and undemanding and loving. So if you are this person, please leave me a message at box number 82.
And this will all make sense in the end.
Listeners, we are here with episode 306, and Kevin, I'm excited about this episode because we're reviewing the 1999 film Magnolia from Paul Thomas Anderson. It's a movie that, surprisingly, we haven't really discussed on the podcast in all the previous 305 episodes. We might have mentioned it a few times, but I'm looking forward to this. And we did mention last week, I am stepping down from the podcast here soon. This is my second to last episode. So next week,
oh man,
it'll be the last episode. But I'm excited because we get to do something fun today, a little bit different. And then we're going to do something fun next week. But I was thinking about this, Kevin. And it made me a little sad because last week was the last new film that I will review, or I did review, on Seeing and Believing, at least as a co-host. We talked about The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Now we're doing Magnolia, and then next week we're doing something special, but no new films. And there's some great movies coming out. I'm jealous. Whoever gets to talk to you about Dune, whoever gets to talk to you about West Side Story, I saw the trailer for the first time, and I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, well, you know, Wade, I know that you are, you know, stepping down as the regular co-host, but I hope you don't think that I'm going to let you get away without occasionally Shanghaiing you back into the co-hosting chair for, you know, a guest spot, a guest episode here and there. So don't think you're off the hook, because you're totally not.
Oh, man. No. I love that. I think that'd be great. I will say the one thing keeping me from being an emotional wreck today, Kevin, is I realized that I'm not going to have to review Dear Evan Hansen. This is the good news in a sad series of episodes.
Yeah, you know, there's a part of me that it's almost the opposite for, because I kind of would like to hear you splutter your way through a review about, you know, why he's 30 years old and he's playing high school. I just, those thoughts are just, they're going to be lost like tears and rain. And I don't know, I'm still in the mourning process for it. So I appreciate your sensitivity during this difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, normally I would love to go see a nice, happy 10:30 p.m. showing during the weekday of Dear Evan Hansen. But yeah. not it's not gonna happen. I don't know if I'll ever see the movie. Maybe I will. I don't know. But I'm not gonna be rushing to see it in theaters. But no, we've got a great show planned for you today. And Kevin, we've got to talk about why we're reviewing Magnolia. We have a Patreon for our podcast, and one of our donors, our Patreon members, is James Hutton, and he is at the $10 a month level, meaning once a year, he gets to choose a film for us to review. And he chose a very ambitious movie. He chose Magnolia, which, like I said before, I'm actually very excited to talk about this movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to pledge at $10 a month to our Patreon, you know, go big or go home, right? Like, mm-hmm. something really ambitious is very fitting for that kind of power, I guess, that James Hutton wields over this podcast. So mm-hmm. I hope that we do him proud, and I think it'll be a good discussion.
Yes. So let's go ahead and jump right into that. I'll give you the quick official synopsis for Magnolia for those of you who have not seen this film. I will say, because it was released in 1999, over 20 years ago, so about to be 22 years.
Oh, man.
I know, right? We are going to talk about the plot of the film. And we already talked about frogs. If you haven't seen the movie, you're like, what does that mean? We are going to give away some spoilers. So if you have not watched the movie and you want to see it first, go ahead and pause the podcast. Though I would think that this is one of those movies you could listen to some spoilers about it and it doesn't really lose any energy. But I do want to put that up there before we begin. So here is the official synopsis. On a random day in the San Fernando Valley, a dying father, a young wife, a male caretaker, a famous lost son, a police officer in love, a boy genius, an ex-boy genius, a game show host, and an estranged daughter will each become part of a dazzling multiplicity of plots with one story. That's a lot of protagonists, Kevin. I think there's a total of 9 protagonists in this picture. It's definitely an ambitious movie by Paul Thomas Anderson. This is the second time for me to watch this film. And interestingly enough, Kevin, I remembered most of what I had seen from the first viewing because I saw it probably about 7-8 years ago. And so it was really fascinating to be able to watch it again. I like this movie. I think I've said in the past, this might be my favorite film of 1999, but I wanted to get your sort of snapshot review. How many times have you seen Magnolia? And what do you think of this puzzling film?
So I'm like you in that this was my second viewing of the movie. I watched it for the first time probably, I don't know, maybe a few years after it was released. And at that time, I was still pretty new to anything that wasn't like mainstream, you know, popular cinema. Yeah. So suffice to say that I didn't really appreciate it at the time. It kind of went over my head. And so I was really looking forward to seeing it again with fresh eyes. And, you know, I guess I often like revisiting the critical darlings that I disliked the first time, because it gives me the chance to sort of see, you know, ask myself, what was I missing, and to kind of try to sift through it again and see it afresh. So that's kind of my history with the movie. I don't know that I would be as positive about it as you. If I had a word, I guess, to sum up my overall reaction to the movie, it's that I think it's a little bit uneven. Where there's times when you're watching this movie where it is the greatest movie you've ever seen. There's some really incredible sequences. And then there are other parts of this movie that it feels a little bit less vital, at least for me. And I'm looking forward to kind of talking about that, because I think in a way, with a movie that's this sprawling and ambitious, that's almost an inevitability in some sense, that there's just going to be, its reach is going to exceed its grasp at some points, and other points it's going to swing for the fences and really, you know, make a big hit. And I think that's something we're going to sift through with this movie. I will say that I appreciated it more on the second go around, mainly because I appreciated the, I don't want to say spiritual vision of it necessarily, but the way that Paul Thomas Anderson really finds a way to suggest a cosmic through line for all of these various stories that he presents in a way that doesn't feel so much like mere coincidence. And I guess because the movie begins with this narration about how there are some coincidences so incredible that they can't be mere coincidence, that feels part and parcel of what he's doing here. And I think that overall he's very successful at it.
Yeah. This is not like that movie Crash, where all these distinct characters and they somehow come together at the end. This feels bigger and more epic than that. There are a couple characters in this film that I don't necessarily take to all that much. And it surprised me, because the first time I watched this is over 3 hours long. First time I watched this, it just felt, it was a lot. And then I go back and I watch it again, knowing what happens. What I was surprised to find about this viewing is how little time we spend with each character. And it shouldn't be surprising, because even though the movie is 3 hours long, there's so many protagonists that we don't spend all that much with each of them. And yet, I felt like I really understood the plight of these characters. I feel for each of these characters. And the angst, the hopelessness is tangible. This is one of those movies, it's filled with a lot of unhappy people. The people in this film, they're either dying of cancer, watching a loved one die of cancer, cheating on a spouse, or being cheated on. That's what it feels like anyway. It's just, it's a tough movie to sit through. And then we get to the end, and there's just this powerful force that brings about a type of forgiveness and a type of grace. And it does this in a way that is both contrived and not contrived. So you mentioned, Kevin, that opening sequence where they talk about these random chances, and if these chances, the narrator says at one point, if these occurrences happened in the plot of a movie, we would say it's unbelievable, like it's fake, it's contrived. And then the movie simultaneously gives us a number of contrived scenes. There's one sequence where all the characters in the main characters in the film sing along together. And then there are the frogs that come down from the sky. And I was struck by this sense of reality and the hand of the filmmaker being present together. And I think that's a metaphor for spiritual matters too in this film. But it's fascinating to just kind of see that play out, because the movie ends in a way you don't expect a film like this to end. It's not bleak. It is happy, but not completely happy. And yet at the same time, it very much feels like a movie. It's not a true story. So yeah, I don't know. There's just kind of just a lot happening here. It's tough to really peel back the layers of this flower, this magnolia flower.
You're right that there's definitely, I think Anderson wants us to think about, I guess, his role as the creator of these stories, partly because the biblical reign of frogs at the end, and it is biblical. Over the course of the film, the verse Exodus 8:2 pops up from time to time in the frame. Like, there's an advertisement that has it. Somebody in the studio audience of this game show is holding a sign that says Exodus 8:2. And that's, of course, the verse that talks about the plague of frogs on Egypt that Moses calls down on Pharaoh. And Anderson is very much wanting us to have that kind of, be in that kind of cosmic mindset, and maybe link that with his role as the sort of the puppet master who's pulling the strings of these very various complex plot lines and sort of tying them together. So there's even a scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman's nurse, Phil, he's on the phone with an operator at an organization that maybe can lead him to the long lost son of the man that Phil is caring for. And in this scene, he makes this impassioned plea that this is like one of those scenes in a movie where somebody is, you know, trying to desperately to find, to reunite a son with his father before the father passes away. And I believe that those scenes are in movies because things like that do happen. Things like that are true. And I'm begging you to do what the character in this movie does and help me out here. And that's just, it's such a naked appeal to the audience that says, you know, this might seem, as you said, Wade, contrived, but it's really begging the audience to try to move past the sense of the narrative strings being pulled and really access the beating heart that's kind of underlying that narrative, and really think about, well, what kind of emotions is this movie asking me to feel? Can I open myself up to them? Mm-hmm. And I think that more often than not, this movie does succeed at really bringing the audience along in that ride. This isn't, like you mentioned Crash earlier, this isn't one of those movies where, you know, there's lots of interlocking plot lines and you're kind of sitting there the entire time thinking about how it's really trying to manipulate you into some sort of, it's almost trying to brute force you, I guess, into the sense that, oh, we're all connected somehow. Whereas Magnolia does that, but because Anderson is so skilled at using metafiction and these other elements, like the part where all the characters are singing along to the Amy Mann song on the soundtrack, those work in a way that kind of bypasses your defenses. And I think that's partly why Magnolia has the reputation that it has, whereas movies like Crash or Amores Perros kind of have seen their reputations kind of dim a little bit over time.
Mm. Well, and weather also plays a key role here with kind of understanding the movie, it being pretty fair weather at the beginning of the picture. And then when the conflict ramps up, it begins to just absolutely pour. And these are all just natural occurrences in the weather. And then a supernatural occurrence appears. And it does feel very biblical. If you think about the plagues in this plague in Exodus 8, it is a sign of God's control and his sovereignty. You think about the Pharaoh, about Pharaoh and about his might, and the plagues are essentially God saying, hey, I'm really in control and you're not. And that is definitely an idea present in this movie. These characters are outside of their control. They do have some sort of agency, but not complete agency. And it brings up another theme in the movie, and that's of the attachment to previous generations. You have characters who are hurt as adults because of what happened to them as children. You see sins passed from fathers to sons, and it's really just kind of expressed in the, I don't know if it's the most famous line in the movie, but it's the one that I'm most familiar with, is we may be done with the past or finished with the past, but the past isn't finished with us. And William H. Macy's character at one point quotes from another passage in Exodus where he talks about the sins being passed down from the fathers to the children. So you have all these characters are sort of fighting against these forces that they can't control, and they're attempting to make amends for that, to receive forgiveness. And it really only happens when the frogs come. And it's just so fascinating how that one storm changes the entire film. You're really at the all is lost moment, and that quote unquote supernatural event is what turns everything around. It's a bold choice by Anderson, and I can definitely see why some people are pretty unhappy with it, or were or are. It's the deus ex machina on purpose to make a point here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably count myself among the crowd that just isn't fully satisfied by the apocalyptic reign of frogs here at the end. And I use apocalypse kind of in the biblical sense, right? The unveiling of something, because mm-hmm. that's kind of what Anderson is going for here, is that he's a lot of the characters reach resolution or find redemption, or at least come to terms with something that has happened to them by the time the frogs arrive. I think for me, what is unsatisfying to me is it doesn't really feel like the frogs don't really feel like they're freighted with any meaning. They're kind of just an event that happens simultaneously with a lot of these reconciliations and revelations, instead of an event that is somehow linked to them. And then maybe that's why it feels less satisfying to me. It feels a little bit like Paul Thomas Anderson needed a big bang at the end to kind of catalyze the intersection of all these plot lines. But there's not really, I don't know, for me, it doesn't work very effectively as symbol, because the frogs themselves don't really mean anything. They're just kind of something vaguely biblical that are thrown onto the screen. At least that's how I see it.
Hmm.
I think the film is strongest when it permits Anderson to draw these connections simply through editing. There's a lot of scenes where we see, you know, one character in the process of doing something, and as they do that action, there's a cut, and we're suddenly with another plot line, and the implied link there does a lot to deepen and enrich both those stories, more so than any sort of heavy-handed narrative mood where two characters encounter each other because the frogs suddenly start raining from the sky, if that makes sense.
Hmm. No, yeah. That's fascinating. It is fascinating to be on the other side of that, and just how contentious that section of the movie is. And it's just fascinating to me, these very explicit references in the movie. Just that Claudia's father's name is Jimmy, and then she meets a Jim, and she projects a lot of her feelings for her father on Jim eventually, which almost breaks them apart. And that's very heavy-handed. At the beginning of the movie, we have this very heavy-handed, hey, you're going to see something that doesn't make sense later on, but those things happen in real life. You mentioned cuts here, Kevin. Watching this film, and since I've seen this for the first time, I've had a chance to really kind of work through a lot of Scorsese's filmography. And I'm reminded a lot of some of his shot choices. And it feels like Anderson is definitely kind of pulling from that vein. I get some Goodfellas vibe here. The choice of music, while it is very different than Scorsese, Scorsese does lean on songs in his movies. The quick camera work in Anderson's film here is just reminiscent of something we'd see in a Scorsese picture. Do you see any connections there for that? How did you feel about the form of this film?
I mean, the Scorsese influences are definitely Anderson doesn't try to hide it at all. I mean, there's this, you know, these long tracking shots through the bowels of the TV network station where the game show is played, and you know, we kind of follow one set of characters, and then we kind of branch off and follow another character for a little while, and then the camera veers off course, and we're with the first character again, and that's kind of a way that Scorsese used in Goodfellas to sort of suggest the way that everything comes together for Henry Hill when he's in the mob, right? Like he moves through this world as fluidly as the camera is moving the audience through the world, and we're kind of permitted access to the world in a similar way. With this film, though, Anderson he's suggesting that to extent, but he also uses that to suggest, again, the unified reality in which all these characters live and the way that motifs have a tendency to replay in lives that are geographically separated or lives that are kind of like, you know, all kind of bumping into each other in this TV network station. I think one of the film's highlights is that sequence that you mentioned earlier where there's the Amy Mann soundtrack. I think it's called Wise Up. It's playing on the soundtrack, and you're kind of prepared for something like Scorsese where it's playing over a montage and you kind of strap yourself in for that kind of a sequence. And then when the characters begin to sing along with it and we move from person to person, that I think is a really strong sequence. And it's that I think that really brings the spiritually tinged cosmic unity of this movie to the fore in a very strong way, much stronger, I guess, in my opinion, than The Frogs, but also, you know, Scorsese himself being a really spiritual producer, having that link in the film's visual influences, I guess, really makes, at least for me watching this, that brought that fully to my mind and helped me really engage with it on the level that I think Anderson intends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think the first time I saw it, I wasn't working in that vein, but it is very apparent. The performances, I didn't actually read off many of the cast members. I probably should have done that at the beginning of this segment. Tom Cruise, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Julianne Moore, Jason Robards, Philip Baker Hall, William H. Macy, among many others. John C. Reilly, who is maybe the heart of the film or the moral conscience of the movie. The cast is just phenomenal. And Tom Cruise, of course, won, I believe he won Best Supporting Actor here his scene, he's very crude, and it does make me uncomfortable in some scenes, but he's really good here. Another person who might also be the heart of the movie is Philip Seymour Hoffman. So you've got John C. Reilly, who is conducting these cops-style monologues with, there's no camera there. He's speaking to himself. And he says a line at the end of the movie that I think is really what the film is trying to say in a nutshell. And he says this, sometimes people need a little help. Sometimes people need to be forgiven. And I think that's a big point in the picture. And then, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman, he won't let go to the hope that reconciliation can occur. And so he's doing his best to unite Earl's character with the character played by Tom Cruise, Mackie. He's trying to bring them together. So both of those characters, Philip Seymour Hoffman, John C. Reilly, they seem to have this moral centering that guides the film along.
Yeah, that closing speech by Reilly's character really puts you in mind of the Apostle Paul in some ways. He's talking about, I'm an officer of the law and I follow the law, but also sometimes people need a little forgiveness. And I mean, that's straight out of Paul, the tension between law and grace. And, you know, how is it possible to break out of the shackles of, you know, constantly following the law and being condemned if you don't? And the answer that Reilly's character gives us is, well, you offer forgiveness, you offer help, you offer grace. And that's, I think for me, why, you know, even though Philip Seymour Hoffman is definitely like, you look at him, he's like just, you know, lawful, good, pure-hearted. He's a great character. And, but I think for me, Reilly really feels to me like the part of the film, or the character in the film, I guess, that I just really feel connected to. And it's maybe telling that the last image of the movie we see, it's him sitting at the bedside of Claudia, who, you know, walked out on him on their date and obviously has a lot of problems, but he's sitting on the edge of her bed and he's speaking to her. We can't really fully hear exactly what he's saying. It's kind of mixed on the sound. The sound mix is kind of making sure it's muffled, so we're only catching snatches, but it's obvious that he's very gently explained to her that, you know, she's a good person, that he desires to be with her. And the last image is of her looking directly into the camera and kind of cracking this broken but hopeful smile. And I think it's just a real humdinger of a closing image. It's really great. Mm-hmm. And does so much. I think it's touches like that that tie the movie all together for me. And the more heavy-handed scenes like the Reign of Frogs, or even the scenes where there's a lot of acting going on, but there's not really necessarily a lot of interesting acting going on.
Okay.
I think there are a few scenes in this movie where I feel like Anderson really directed his actors to go for broke and go large. And I think those moments are less powerful for me than the ones like the gaze I just described, that's the film's final image, or Tom Cruise's Frank T.J. Mackey just, you know, looking into the camera and quietly whispering, I'm quietly judging you. Those moments, I think, are the ones that really punch me in the gut. And I think the movie is better in those moments than it is in the more, the showy Oscar moments, I guess.
Now, how did you feel about the scene where we hear "Thus spake Zarathustra" as Tom Cruise begins his very aggressive masculine conference?
Oh man, I really like that scene. And great. I think that's Anderson being witty. He's obviously like, this is how Mackie kind of sees himself, or at least this is the way he wants his audience to see him. And even the way he gives his talk, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I want to really highlight how Cruise's performance of Mackie giving this speech at this conference is very much modeled on the vocal cadences street preachers or tent revival preachers. He's like, I want you to, you know, like to embrace your mass, you know, like, he doesn't use a word as big as masculinity, but you know, it's that kind of like, you know, I want you to feel something. He's really milking it for all it's worth. And I think, I don't know, I really like that. And I think it's another sneaky way for Anderson to suggest the ways that people look for deeper meaning in things that simply don't satisfy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And it definitely seems to be sex here throughout the lives of many characters. This search for that, this search for success as well. You have a character, Jimmy's character, who is dying of cancer. He can barely make it through a show, and yet he just won't stop. What drives that? And I do want to go back and point out, we're talking about John C. Reilly's character. I think it's important to note that if he is the moral center of the picture, and at least you and I agree that he is at least the center or one of the two people, he does pray before he heads out to work. He talks about Jesus sending calls to him. And I think there's something there. I think the religious elements are not just for show. I think there's kind of something there, at least a point to the transcendent. I do want to read a quote. David Rourke, who's been on the show once or twice in the past, he wrote an article about this film for Relevant Magazine, and it's still out there. We'll put it in the show notes. It's not a long article, but it's an article I read, I believe it was right after I saw the movie. And I love his interpretation of it. And he says this, it's kind of a longer quote, but I'll say this. He says about the film, it's kind of an encapsulation of it. Formerly enslaved to the past, to pain, the protagonists are delivered by an unexplainable force that gives them the power to face and overcome their problems and to love one another in a way that surpasses any shortcomings an individual may have. This redemption doesn't arrive by any particular character's own merit. The characters have already proven they are incapable of escaping their personal hells through their own strength. The healing and forgiveness they obtain is instead implemented by the hand of something greater, something without human fault, something perfect, something divine, and I believe that something is God. Playing an active role in Anderson's story, he is the driving force that intervenes when nothing else will go right, when all hope is lost. I think it's a really good interpretation. I don't know if I'm as confident to say, hey, like it is necessarily God. Anderson means that. But when I watch it, I do kind of walk away saying, yeah, there are forces at work. That's something at least acknowledged by Anderson here. And we need that. We need some sort of higher force. Now, as a Christian, of course, I would interpret that a certain way. But I do think those themes are present in the movie.
I do think David's reading, I mean, I think that's a fair reading of the film. And Anderson certainly makes that obvious through his use of clear biblical allusions. So, you know, there's definitely something there. And regardless of his personal beliefs, I think Anderson is very intentionally saying we do need something besides ourselves. We need more than other people as well. Like there are people who can support us, but they are just as likely to abandon us or to hurt us in ways. And so we can't fully rely just simply on humanity to save us as well. There has to be something else. There's, you know, one of the refrains that we hear throughout the film is William H. Macy's former boy genius saying, you know, my name is Donnie Smith and I have lots of love to give.
Mm.
And one of the final scenes in the film is one that he shares with Riley's police officer where he says, I have so much, all this love and I don't know where to put it. I don't know what is a deserving recipient of that love is essentially what he's saying in that moment. And I mean, obviously for a Christian viewer, it's obvious where that love should go. And even a non-Christian viewer, if they're paying attention to this film, they have to be thinking, well, if people can't, if we can't just put all of our faith and love in people, what else is there? And Paul Thomas Anderson might be saying, well, where did the frogs fall from? And invite us to look up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love what you've said. And maybe we have talked about this movie in the past, but the idea of this is an apocalyptic event. And apocalypse, the unveiling, the uncovering. And we get a lot of people bringing the truth to light here. And that seems like it's going to cause a lot of harm. But for those looking for that unveiling, that uncovering, that apocalypse, it reveals what is evil, and it destroys that so that good can foster. And so the quote-unquote apocalypse is, in at least according to Scripture, for the just, that is something that we look forward to. We look forward to evil being defeated. And we get some of those themes here. Listeners, that is our review of Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. It's currently streaming on Netflix. So if you have a Netflix subscription, you can watch that. If you don't, then it's everywhere. You can rent it and check it out, and we'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Kevin, this is the end of our show. It's the part of the show where we recommend something from the world of television and or film to our listeners. What would you like to recommend to us today?
Well, this is a movie that I have recommended on a previous episode, but it just seemed too appropriate given this the movie we talked about today to not recommend it again. And it's another Paul Thomas Anderson film. It's another Paul Thomas Anderson film that really feels indebted to Scorsese, and for my money, I'm not sure if it's his best film, but it's probably one of his two best films, I say, and I think that would be Boogie Nights. This is his look at the world of pornography, and so for that reason, there's obviously some subject matter that listeners would want to exercise discernment about before going into this movie blind. But I think that if you can engage with the content of this movie wisely, it just has such, I think it's just such an incredible look at American culture, about the way that self-mythologizing of the sort that we see these characters engage in, and that in a way pornography itself invites to kind of like indulge fantasies about oneself or about others. About how that's really a thin veneer, and underneath is ugliness and sadness and deep, deep need, and maybe even a spiritual void. I think all of that is present in Boogie Nights. I think it's got the same, it's just got this wonderful energy about the filmmaking that ensures that maybe whereas Magnolia is a little bit more, morose and a little bit more, you really... It's a much sadder movie in a lot of ways, but Boogie Nights, I think, hits at a lot of the same themes, but does so with a verve that is just, in some places, just very exhilarating. So I think it's very much worth the time needed to engage with it. So that's my recommendation for this week.
I have not seen the film, just because it is a tough subject matter, right? But it's one that I've heard very much about. And I heard you talk about it a couple times, so I think maybe here in the near future. I think Paul Thomas Anderson, it looks like he might release a film this year by the end of the year. So might need to go back and watch Boogie Nights and maybe Hard Eight. I haven't seen Hard Eight. Have you watched Hard Eight?
Yeah, I've seen Hard Eight. I think it. I mean, given the fact that it's he was an unknown at the time, Hard Eight is a really accomplished piece of work. I don't think it's, you can definitely feel like Anderson is still developing his talent and hasn't quite figured out what to do with all the talent he has, but the elements are definitely there, and it's a really interesting watch. So yeah, it's worth your time if you want to kind of fill in your PTA gaps before his newest film comes out. That's a good watch, and yeah, I think Boogie Nights is just really great too. And it's, you know, it's got Mark Wahlberg's best performance, like career best from
that's
him.
What I've
so,
heard. You
know, it's got that going for it as well.
I've heard that it's got his best performance. He also made he made a joke one time. He's like, I hope God didn't watch that movie. So I'm not really sure his scenes in there, but that's what he said. He's on record. I'm gonna go in a different direction with my pick. There's a documentary series that just released on Amazon Prime called Lula Rich, and it follows LuLaRoe, the multi-level marketing billion-dollar clothing company for women. And this is a four-episode series. It's not necessarily going to blow you away in terms of its production. I also think the film probably should have interviewed more people who were hurt by this organization, by this company, but it does tell the story of the rise of LuLaRoe and how this multi-level marketing scheme hurt many people, including those who made a lot of money in this game. And I like watching business type documentaries like this, because it just really kind of makes me think. I think it's a window, at least multi-level marketing, into many of our hopes and our dreams and our desires. And this film says something about patriarchy. It says something about motherhood. It says something about women in 21st century America. But it also says something about our desire to get rich and to get rich quick. And I think there's some fascinating pieces of dialogue here, interviews here, that do at least allude to that. And so it got me thinking about that. And I think some of our listeners would be interested in this four-part documentary. So yeah, it's currently playing streaming on Amazon Prime. It is directed by Jenner First and Julia Willoughby-Nason. So yeah, that's my pick for the week.
Yeah, you know, we talked a little bit about that offline after recording last week's episode, and it sounded really interesting. So I might have to check that out. Sounds pretty neat.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, an easy watch.
So speaking of last week's episode, there's one thing finally I wanted to do, Wade, before we close things out on this episode. So listeners, as we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, Wade is hanging up his podcast co-host spurs for the foreseeable future, and we are going to be sad to see him, you know, ride off into the sunset. And so I'd like to extend an invitation as we get close to the farewell episode for Wade, the goodbye bonanza, or whatever you want to call it. If any of you have fond memories of his time on the show, or, you know, a particularly fun seeing and believing moment, or just maybe some words to share about, you know, Wade's, you know, his critical vision, or just something he said that you've really appreciated, pointed you towards, whatever it might be, let us know. We are collecting sound clips from listeners who want to maybe record a few seconds of audio for Wade to kind of see him off, or if you just want to send us a tweet or an email, we're kind of like collecting those together as a little farewell gift for Wade. So I'm issuing this call now. We'll also be kind of reminding you maybe on Twitter over the next few days, but definitely if you have anything like that to share and feel so led, send it my way or the podcast way. It's pretty much one and the same at this point as I kind of take over the machinery of seeing and believing. So I want to throw that out there and get something put together for Wade as he waves goodbye and, you know, has his moment from The Searchers where he steps out the doorway There it framed is. In the doorway, and then the door closes behind him.
No, that's really nice, Kevin. I really do appreciate that. Yeah, thanks to our listeners. And I'll have more to say next week, but man, been a great 6.5 years. Listeners, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. It's brought to you by ChristandPopCulture.com. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.